Good afternoon. Welcome to the 6th Annual 21st Century CORV Discovery Lecture. I'm Brian Foster. I'm provost here at MU. I'd like to say that Chancellor Deaton would like to be here. This is an event that he's very engaged with, but he's in Thailand receiving an honorary degree, so he just couldn't take the afternoon off and get back. So anyway, I'm happy to be here to be able to welcome you. I want to thank you for joining us as we gather to share the spirit of discovery and explore new frontiers in knowledge, both at the very heart of our university's mission. At the first public university west of the Mississippi, MU faculty members share a rich history with the Lewis and Clark expedition. Like the findings of the CORV discovery more than 200 years ago, their research and scholarship have made profound differences in the world. Just a few examples. People at MU have improved the treatment and prevention of diabetes and helped develop home dialysis for kidney patients. MU people have developed previously unpublished works, discovered previously unpublished works by such famous authors as Mark Twain, Charlotte Bronte, Tennessee Williams, William Faulkner, Jack Kerouac. They've improved the quality of life of a generation of arthritis sufferers by proving that regular exercise is the best treatment for the condition. And they've conducted landmark studies in crop rotation that are the basis for today's sustainable agriculture. And I guess I'd just like to make the point, the breadth of all of these different areas of discovery is really quite stunning. The 21st Century CORV Discovery Lecture is given annually by one of MU's most distinguished faculty members as a way to celebrate our core value of discovery and bring together the university community at the beginning of each academic year. This event also keeps alive Thomas Jefferson's dream of education as the cornerstone of American democracy and is part of our land-grant university heritage. I want to take a moment to thank Betty Winfield from School of Journalism and Susan Flatter from History for their original proposal. Without their vision and the support of Chancellor Richard Wallace, we wouldn't be here this afternoon and this event wouldn't exist. Is Richard here this afternoon? Well, anyway, to Richard Wallace, thank you very much for your efforts to put this series of lectures together. I'd also like to briefly recognize our previous CORV Discovery speakers. If you're here, when I call your name, would you please just wave and we can acknowledge and thank you for your presence. John Miles Foley. John is director of MU's Center for Studies on Oral Tradition and Curator's Professor of Classical Studies and English. He is not here today, I guess. Alan Bludorn. He is the Emma S. Hibbs Distinguished Professor of Management and Associate Dean of the Graduate Studies and Research at the Trulasc College of Business. Glenn Cameron. Yes, I saw Glenn earlier. Glenn is the Maxine Wilson Gregory Chair in Journalism and Co-Director and Scientific Advisor of the Health Communication Research Center at MU. Randy Prather. Randy here. Don't see him. Randy is Curator's Professor of Reproductive Physiology and Molecular Biology and Co-Director of the National Swine Resource and Research Center. This afternoon, it's my privilege to introduce you to the 2009 21st Century CORV Discovery Lecturer, Dr. Mark Smith, who is a Curator's Professor of History from the College of Arts and Science. Professor Smith's research has earned him a place among the top echelon of humanistic scholars. He was one of only a handful of applicants to receive a highly selective 2007 Guggenheim Foundation Fellowship, and he's received numerous grants from National Science Foundation and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Dr. Smith is a true pioneer. He told me I should say he's a pseudo-pioneer, but I'm going to say he's a true pioneer in his field. Please welcome him and enjoy his CORV Discovery Lecture entitled, More Than Meets the Eye, What Made the Printing Revolution Revolutionary. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, did you take my... Brian.
Would you like to give it?
Oh, I did. I just wanted to see if you had it.
Actually, I remember it perfectly. Now, thanks, Brian, for a blissfully short introduction. I'd also like to thank those of your administrative staff, Laura Roloff in particular, who've helped in various crucial ways to make this lecture possible. Most of all, though, I'd like to thank you for being here to make it actual. As you'll soon see, this lecture depends on a tight coordination between my narrative and a long, complex series of PowerPoint slides, which means that in order to get it right, I have to hit the forward button at precisely the right spot. See? Technology is wonderful. In precisely the right sequence, and I have to do it inerrantly more than 200 times. So I ask you to pause with me a moment as I offer a slightly modified version of that brief but achingly poignant prayer uttered by astronaut Alan Shepard just before his launch in May of 1961. Dear God, please don't let me screw up. Okay, now that I've appealed to heaven, I'll get down to earth. 30 years ago, Elizabeth Eisenstein published a major two-volume study of the early printing industry entitled The Printing Press as an Agent of Change. 4 years later, it appeared in abridged form as The Printing Revolution in Early Modern Europe. Thanks in great part to the force of her analysis in these two works, we now take it for granted that the transition from manuscript to print wrought seismic changes in the intellectual and cultural landscape of early modern Europe. For one thing, printing led to a far wider and quicker dissemination of texts and ideas than had been possible before the mid-15th century. Indeed, by the mid-16th century, print shops were mass-producing books in what amounts to assembly line fashion. For another thing, printing allowed for a standardization of texts that was unachievable through manuscript transmission. The upshot was a commonwealth of learning that extended well beyond the walls of universities, where textual scholarship had been more or less sequestered during the later Middle Ages. In a sense, then, printing democratized reading by widening the reading public. But the evolution of print from the mid-16th, 15th century did more than democratize reading. It also transformed the way texts were read and assimilated by changing the way they were physically presented, by following certain norms of punctuation, by adopting specific fonts, by systematic reorganization, by indexing. In short, by a host of structural changes that affected not only how texts were read, but also how they were interpreted. To paraphrase Marshall McLuhan, the medium of print changed textual messages and meanings in fundamental ways. In order to illustrate this point, I'll focus on one particular text, Ibn al-Haytham's grand optical synthesis Kitab al-Manazir, or Book of Optics, which was composed around 1030 and rendered at the end of the 12th century from Arabic into Latin under the title De Aspectibus, or On Visual Appearances. Ascribed to al-Hasan, the Latin transliteration of Ibn al-Haytham's given name, this massive treatise offers a comprehensive and systematic treatment of its subject, from physical light theory and ray geometry to the physiology and psychology of visual perception. So sophisticated and compelling was Al-Hasan's optical account that by the end of the 13th century, the De Aspectibus had become the authoritative source for optical analysis in Europe, and it remained so to the very end of the 16th century. In 1572, Friedrich Risner published the first printed edition of the De Aspectibus in a compendium entitled Opticae Thesaurus, or Treasury of Optics. Some 30 years after this edition appeared, the science of optics took a revolutionary turn toward the modern at the hands of Johann Kepler, whose work on optics, particularly on retinal focusing in the eye, eventually undermined Al-Hasan's synthesis to its core. There's no doubt that this development would not have occurred, or at least not so quickly, had the De Aspectibus not been so readily available in Risner's edition. Kepler's work in optics, in fact, grew out of a close critical scrutiny of Al-Hasan's text in that edition. Nor is there any doubt that Risner went to great lengths to ensure that his edition of the De Aspectibus would be definitive. To that end, he collated two manuscripts, incorporating his own editorial changes wherever logic or style dictated, in order to remove all ambiguities of reading or reasoning inherent in the manuscript versions he used. Risner thus made the text of the De Aspectibus far more accessible than it had been before 1572, and he did so in two ways. First, by making more copies of it available, and second, by making it clear and unambiguous, and therefore easier to read. But Risner didn't just render the De Aspectibus more easily readable. By importing certain key structural changes into that text, he opened it to a fundamentally different way of reading that was neither feasible nor intended in its manuscript form. This new way of reading the text, I suggest, was as instrumental in the transformation of optics begun in the early 17th century as the wider availability of the text itself. More to the point,
This new way of reading text, or at least scientific texts, was as revolutionary in its implications and consequences as the development of print itself. That, in a nutshell, is the case I'll try to make today. Before turning to that case, though, I need to take you through a crash course in Latin paleography. That is, the analysis of medieval handwriting and its forms, and codicology, the analysis of manuscript production. Let's start with a sample of what most of us probably have in mind as a typical medieval manuscript, the Lutrell Psalter, a collection of psalms plus some other odds and ends, produced by commissioned for Sir Geoffrey Lutrell in the early 14th century. Obviously, this was a deluxe production, a masterpiece of conspicuous consumption, exemplifying the finest materials and workmanship of the time. The quality of the workmanship is evident in the handwriting, which is as clear as it is aesthetically pleasing. The passage outlined in red here is the beginning of the 94th Psalm in the Vulgate Latin, and you may be able to make it out even without the transcription in Roman font I've provided on the side. Here, on the other hand, is a manuscript roughly contemporary with the Lutrell Psalter. An academic commentary on Aristotle's Physics, this manuscript is far more typical of the period. It's designed for not for show, but for actual use, and it's obviously designed for efficient use of space rather than for aesthetic effect. An amazing amount of text is crammed into this one page. Yet for all their apparent differences, these two manuscripts have much in common. So let's examine some of these commonalities using the Lutrell Psalter as our starting point. Look at the word Dominus highlighted in yellow here. Here's a magnified version. The script is called textura quadrata, loosely translated as angled woven because of its woven or embroidered look and its formation according to angular strokes. Take the O highlighted in yellow. You'll see that it's a hexagon, not a circle or ellipse. As such, it's formed by a succession of diagonal and vertical strokes of the pen, which are made thick or thin according to the slant of the nib. Now look at the left-hand leg of the M. This is called a minim. The simplest form of the minim is a straight downward stroke, but in this case it consists of three separate strokes as illustrated here. The M itself comprises three minims, and the scribe has taken care to link the top strokes so that the top of the M is linked, whereas the bottoms of the legs are somewhat separated. Now look at the word adiutorium highlighted here in yellow. Note that the final M is missing and that a macron or line has been drawn over the U. This is a standard abbreviation to denote a missing M or N. The same convention is used with ipsorum here. Now let's look at the word noster highlighted here to the left in yellow and compare it to the same word here highlighted in yellow to the right. In the second noster, the ending is left off and replaced with a sort of squiggly apostrophe that stands for the sound er, ur, or ir. Finally, it's worth noting that words were commonly split between lines without hyphenation. Disperdet, highlighted in yellow here, is not two words, but the single word disperdet, just as confessione, highlighted here, is a single word confessione. All of this points to the fact that in order to read even the most carefully done medieval text, one has to know at least a few scribal conventions and be somewhat conversant with Latin. Now let's turn to the second manuscript, which is representative of text used by university students and professors. Let's home in on a swatch outline here in red and magnified here to a readable size. At first glance, the script may seem fundamentally different from that used in the Lutrell Psalter, but it's just a slightly streamlined version of the same textura quadrata. It's not the lettering that makes this text so unreadable, though. It's the jumble of superscripts and diacritical marks that signal abbreviations. Here, inserted below, is a transcription of the first four lines in modern type. Let me take you through part of the text word by word. First comes dicit with a D missing. This was meant to be put in as a large illuminated capital in the space to the left, but is also too common with medieval text. It was never done. Following dicit, we have philosophus, sexto, metaphysicae, tres, sunt partes principales, scientiae, speculative, scilicet, naturalis, mathematica, et divina. From this, it should be eminently clear that in order to read a text of this sort, one has to know a great deal about scribal conventions and be well enough versed in Latin to fill in blanks. So why make things so difficult that only an expert can read the text? The primary reason is efficiency. The more license the scribe had to abbreviate, the faster he could reproduce the text. Scribes, after all, were professionals and were paid for their time. Cell phone texting offers a loose modern analogy in that the abbreviations are fairly conventional and are meant to speed up typing for the sake of both time and expense. In addition, the more that could be packed onto a manuscript page, the less medium was necessary. The medium, of course, was parchment, which came in different grades according to animal, generally calf, sheep, or goat, and age. The younger the animal, the finer the skin. No matter what grade was used, though, the production of parchment was nasty and enormously time and labor intensive, involving multiple stages from removing the hair to sizing and cutting. Then there's the expense of the animal itself. For instance, the Codex Amiatinus, a huge Bible produced in England around 700, weighs over 75 pounds and is estimated to have consumed over 1,500 calf skins. It wouldn't have taken many books of this size to have brought cattle to extinction in 8th century England, much as the mass production of leisure suits in the 1970s drove polyesters to near extinction in America. Wealthy patrons like Geoffrey Luttrell could afford to spare no expense on parchment, so they had no need to crowd the pages with text, hence the large lettering and relative lack of abbreviations. Academics, on the other hand, had to pinch pennies, which is why university texts were so densely packed. I should add that linen paper was available in Spain before 1100 and produced in fairly sizable quantities in northern Italy by the late 13th century. Nonetheless, paper never gained favor in the high and later Middle Ages, in part because its quality was suspect and in part because it was no cheaper than parchment. It was only in the early 15th century that paper became more economical than parchment, and by the mid-15th century, when Johann Gutenberg printed his Bible, it was about six times less expensive than parchment. So far, we've looked at only one kind of medieval Gothic script, the angular woven version. Common though it was throughout the period from roughly 1200 to the end of the Middle Ages, it had rivals such as the rotunda script shown here or the lettre bâtarde shown here. But all these scripts were based on a common progenitor, the Carolingian minuscule script developed in northern France toward the end of the 8th century and perfected by the end of the 9th. Here's a good example. Here, in contradistinction, is an example of a particularly nightmarish script from the mid-ish 8th century, the Luxeuil script, named after the monastery of Luxeuil in eastern France. The streamlined simplicity and clear readability of the Carolingian script is obvious. Dominus in caelo paravit sedem suam et regnum ipsius omnium dominabitur. Note the two types of diacritical marks denoting the final M for sedem, regnum, and omnium, as well as a corresponding diacritical mark over the M in omnium to denote the missing N. Note also the two-shaped superscript over the T in dominabit to denote the missing ur in dominabitur. By contrast, deciphering the Luxeuil script requires a great deal of effort and guesswork, both because of the florid letter shapes and the way the letters tend to be jammed together. Here's a word-by-word transcription. Et videt lenteamina posita et sudarium quod fuerat super caput Domini Jesu. In form and readability, the Carolingian minuscule script is far superior to its Luxeuil counterpart, and for that matter, any of the other scripts contemporaneous with it. That's why the Carolingian minuscule script eventually predominated to form the basis for all subsequent Gothic scripts, as well as for the so-called Roman font adopted by the Renaissance humanists and still in standard use today. Still, no matter how good their orthography or how careful they were as copyists, medieval scribes made errors in transcription, and those errors were compounded in successive copies. Take this text as an example. Notice the word highlighted in red. The scribe rendered it as instantia, which means presence or instance. But the little mark over the in indicates a correction to distantia or distance. Clearly, the difference in meaning between the two versions of the word makes a significant difference in the meaning of the text. As it turns out, this particular mistranscription was corrected, but many were not, and they were bound to be incorporated into subsequent manuscript copies, changing the thrust of the text in fundamental, sometimes crucial ways. Here's a transcription according to the corrected reading of distantia. Liberally translated, it reads, "Thus, when this apparatus is ground to perfection, we'll mark two diameters on its inner surface and intersect each other orthogonally and that therefore pass through its center. Then, on the base of the apparatus's rim, we'll mark a point whose distance from the ends, etc." The apparatus just mentioned consists of a shallow bronze pan that looks something like this. We're told to produce two diameters perpendicular to one another on the bronze pan's bottom so as to intersect at its center. Now let's go back to the text for a moment. We see that two lines in succession begin with the same word, eius. In such cases, it's easy to commit an I-skip, passing over the first eius to the second one. So what happens when the line beginning with the first eius is dropped by an I-skipping scribe? For one thing, the text still makes some sense without that line. But, as we see here, the meaning has been significantly altered. Gone now are the two diameters, and like poor old Charlie in the Boston MTA, they'll never return in a train of manuscripts copies originating from this one. That chunk of text is permanently lost. These are just two of countless types of scribal errors that can infect a text, and they serve to demonstrate how radically those errors can change the text's meaning. A few words finally on medieval punctuation. Medieval punctuation evolved from a system of word organization or markings meant to control inflection, that is to indicate how a passage should sound if read aloud. Unlike modern punctuation, it was not meant to control syntactical or grammatical structure. Why the difference? Because from late antiquity throughout most of the Middle Ages, texts were commonly read aloud, even when read solo. And they were read aloud not because medieval readers were semi-literate, but because reading the text physically was meant to bolster understanding and memorization. Furthermore, by controlling the sound of the text, punctuation helped the reader to sing it to himself, so to speak, and thereby commit it to memory more easily and naturally verse by verse rather than syntactical chunk by syntactical chunk. Let me give you a brief example. On the screen is a page from the Utrecht Psalter written in the early 9th century. Here's the beginning of Psalm 94, which we briefly examined in the Luttrell Psalter. There are two forms of punctuation at work in this text. First and foremost is punctuation by verse, each of which is indicated by the colored capital to the left of the verse's first line. Second is a set of marks inside and at the end of each verse. These I've put in red in my transcription to the right. Take a look at the first of these marks highlighted here in yellow. At first glance, it could be a syntactical marker because it stands between two independent clauses. Come, let us exult in the Lord. Let us rejoice in God our salvation. But its real purpose is inflectional, not syntactical. It marks an upward shift in voice, as do its counterparts highlighted here in yellow. On the other hand, the three semicolon-like marks highlighted here in yellow indicate a downward shift in voice. Venite exultemus Domino, jubilemus Deo solitari nostro. Priacopemus faciam eos in confessione, et in psalmis jubilemus ei, quoniam Deus magnus dominus et rex magnus super omnis Deus. This same system is evident here in the Luttrell Psalter, although the markings have been modified to what looks like a colon and a period. Up to the 12th century, the majority of texts produced in Europe were devotional and thus susceptible to the kind of inflectional punctuation just discussed. But during the 12th and 13th centuries, a flood of new texts, most of them philosophical or scientific, entered Northern Europe from Northern Spain, Toledo in particular, which had recently been taken out of Muslim control by Christian forces. Most important among these were the works of Aristotle, which were initially translated from Arabic to Latin and much later from Greek into Latin. However much the works of Aristotle may sing to us at the intellectual level, they don't sing at the textual level. There's nothing poetic or metrical about an Aristotelian text. How then to impose order on it? One way is to adapt the old inflectional marks to non-inflectional uses, such as denoting grammatical structure. Another is to develop new kinds of punctuation. On the screen is an example drawn from our own Fragmenta Manuscripta collection here in Ellis Library. This is a page from a canon law commentary written around 1300. The first thing to note is what's called rubrication, that is writing or highlighting in red from rubor, which means red in Latin. This was done not by the scribe, but by a specialist called, of all things, a rubricator. The first piece of rubrication in this text, the large initial capital at the bottom right, isn't really red at all, but no matter, rubrication was often done in different colors, blue being a favorite. Then we have the set of smaller capitals, two of them actually red, the other blue. Next, we have these marks that look suspiciously like the modern paragraph signs used by editors today, and well, they should, because that's essentially what they are. Next, we have the small colored capitals shown here, and finally, we have these light semi-brackets. This is a system of indexing and sub-indexing according to ever-weaker breaks, the strongest being the chapter break signal by the largest capital, the weakest, the last set of breaks signaled by the light semi-brackets. Clearly, the resulting segmentation of the text is not metrical. It's logical, a system of subordinating and, if you will, subsubordinating chunks of text. Let me sum up with 4 points. First, this system of punctuation organizes the text for mental, not vocal assimilation. That's not to say that the text wouldn't have been read aloud, but the punctuation itself is no guide to such vocalization. Second, the system's not designed to organize the text syntactically or grammatically. The subordination according to strong or weak breaks does not mark independent and dependent clauses or appositives as periods, commas, or colons do for us today. Third, this system was often combined with other systems, many of them based on the earlier inflectional marks. And finally, the same text could be punctuated in different ways, sometimes radically different ways by different scribes. As a result, late medieval punctuation often strikes us as capricious, even chaotic, and it often was. Incidentally, the profound effect punctuation can have on a meaning or message of a given text is exemplified in this old chestnut presented here in an unpunctuated string. If we capitalize a W and add a question mark at the end, the message is obvious. But let's put the question mark after in and make the rest a response. The message now is, where's the thing? And the answer is, it's in the road ahead. But what if we put the question mark after the that? The message in this case is ambiguous, but it could be, what kind of thing is that? The answer being, it's the kind of thing that's on the road ahead. This last version speaks for itself. So much for paleography and codicology. Now to books. Predictably enough, we start with the Gutenberg Bible, whose opening page is on the screen. Printed in the early 1450s, this is one of the earliest books, but not the earliest book, produced in Europe with movable type. A couple of preliminary remarks are in order. First, Gutenberg meant this printed edition to emulate a deluxe manuscript version, hence the fact that of the 180 copies Gutenberg eventually produced, 45 were on parchment rather than paper. Hence, too, the large illuminated capital at the beginning, the rubrication, which I've outlined in red, and the floral decoration around the margins. But these embellishments were severely limited by technology. For instance, although Gutenberg began by actually printing a rubrication, which required 2 runs for each page, he soon gave it up as too difficult and costly, leaving the decoration of text to be added by hand after print. Here's a more sparsely decorated page from Exodus. Let's look briefly at the sample of text outlined here, the beginning of chapter 28. The first thing to notice is the font, a beautifully clear textura quadrata in which the M's, N's, U's, and I's are clearly distinguished. The second thing to notice is the inclusion of certain abbreviations that are used fairly sparingly. The macron over the E here denoting the missing letters in fratrem. The macron over the U here to denote the missing M in cum, and this sign used to denote the missing rum in filiorum. All told, in style and format, this text falls squarely within the late medieval tradition of fine manuscript book production. Here's the opening page from the first edition of Euclid's Elements, published by Erhard Radholt in Venice, some 30 years after Gutenberg's Bible. Its links to the university text tradition are obvious in both the punctuation and the relative heavy use of abbreviations, which come in a much wider variety than those used by Gutenberg. Take a look at the passage outlined here in red and blown up to easily readable size here with a transcription of the first 3 lines added below. For a start, unlike Gutenberg, Radholt uses paragraph signs liberally to segment the text, and he combines them with periods to signal full stops. Then there's the abbreviations themselves. The familiar macron here to signal the missing N in non, the dash through the descender of the P here to denote the missing R in pars, this 9-shaped mark to indicate the missing us in cuius, the 3-shaped sign here that stands for et in its highly abbreviated form of habet, the question mark-like sign here that stands for cone in contactus, and this 4-shaped sign denoting the rum in quarum. Here, on the other hand, is a page from a printed version of Cicero's Dream of Scipio, published by Nicolaus Jansen 10 years before Radholt's edition of Euclid. It's clearly not tied to the late medieval textual tradition, but rather to the Renaissance humanist tradition in which the Carolingian minuscule script was adopted as the norm. Here, for example, is a page from a manuscript containing some of Cicero's letters and produced in Florence around 1440. Its roots in the Carolingian minuscule script couldn't be more obvious. The humanists adopted this script, by the way, because they were under the illusion that it was authentically Roman rather than early medieval. The lettering isn't the only thing that links Jensen's text to the humanist tradition. So does the gross punctuation. Paragraphs are signaled not by markers, but by large opening capitals and physical separation. The abbreviations are simple, few, and fairly far between, consisting of macrons is here, the ur sign is here, and the ampersand is here. The internal punctuation is limited to colons and periods, as here, where a full stop is signaled, or here, where a sort of apposition is marked, or here, where a dependent clause is set off. This punctuation, in short, is syntactical and points clearly toward modern punctuation and the concomitant modern emphasis on silent mental reading. Here, finally, is the so-called Aldine font, which is the prototype of what we today call italic. It, too, is both clear, simple, and uncluttered by abbreviations or punctuation marks. Over the 16th century, these two forms of Roman type were increasingly adopted at the expense of Gothic textura quadrata and its variants for two simple reasons. First, it's much more easily readable and decipherable. Second, and at least as important, it requires far fewer special characters in the printer's type case. Imagine a computer keyboard loaded with extra keys for special abbreviation signs and characters, and you can easily understand why a printer would want to streamline both its typeface and the fonts contained in it. Not that the textura quadrata font fell out of use entirely. It was still quite common in books printed in Germany and England throughout the 16th and well into the 17th centuries. Forgive me for dragging you through so much background detail, but it'll make the case study I'm going to embark on now far easier to follow than it would have been otherwise. As I said at the beginning, that study will focus on Alhazen's Deus Spectibus, and it will be based on comparing the manuscript version with Risner's printed edition. When I say manuscript version, I don't mean a single manuscript. There are, in fact, 17 known manuscripts of the Deus Spectibus, and I'll draw liberally from among them. Let's start with some of the more obvious and superficial editorial changes Risner made in response to scribal idiosyncrasies. For instance, as I pointed out earlier, medieval punctuation is often inconsistent, even random. Here's an example based on three versions of the same text, the top two from different manuscripts and the bottom from Risner's edition. Note, first, the strong paragraph breaks in yellow at adoptandum and hiis in the top left version, and the weaker breaks in blue at spericum and in. These breaks are matched in the top right version, except that the one for adoptandum is weaker than that for hiis, whereas the one for in is as strong. Note, too, that in the top right version, there are even weaker breaks highlighted in red, which delineate clauses or phrases. It's possible, though I think unlikely, that this level of punctuation was imposed for the sake of psychological chunking, so as to segment the text into easily assimilable and memorizable gobbets. Such is not the case with Risner's text at the bottom. Although it's roughly parallel to that in the top right version, his punctuation is considerably clearer and more refined, verging toward modern with the imposition of periods, colons, commas, and capitals. Risner, in other words, used punctuation to render the logical intent of the text as transparent as possible according to syntactical structure. Now to certain paleographic issues, starting with minims, the vertical strokes that go into the formation of I, N, U, and M. These are often strung together indiscriminately, as illustrated in the words highlighted in yellow in this slide. Context and a knowledge of Latin make the reading of such words relatively easy in a holistic sense, the top one being diminuta, the lower one minima. In mathematical texts, though, and much of the Deus Spectibus consists of geometrical demonstrations, line or angle designations consisting of minims can't be read holistically because they don't form meaningful words. Take this passage, which is excerpted from a geometrical proof. At first glance, it seems to read, et angulus NNM, equalis angulo IBC, equalis angulo HBA, et angulus HBA, equalis angulo quia angulus NNM, equalis angulo quia, or perhaps QNIA or QMA. Actually, the correct reading is et angulus NMU, equalis angulo IBC, equalis angulo HBA, et angulus HBA, equalis angulo QMA, erit angulus NMU, equalis angulo QMA. But there's no way to be certain about the correct letter combinations without poring through the actual proof and following its logic point by point. The same holds for T, C, E, and R, which in medieval orthography can often be mistaken for one another when strung together out of all meaningful context. Then there's the problem posed by the way such words or phrases as scilicet, meaning namely, any, meaning for or because, and id est, meaning that is, are commonly abbreviated in medieval manuscripts by setting the first letter of the word or phrase between dots. Accordingly, in this slide, S dot highlighted in yellow in the top passage should be read as skillicet, whereas the dot N dot highlighted in yellow in the passage below should be read as enim, and dot I dot in the third passage as id est. In mathematical texts, however, it's common to set off point, line, and angle designations by dots as illustrated in the bottom passage. Where things go awry is when the two conventions collide, as in this example, where the dot and dot highlighted in yellow in the top passage could be taken as enim, as in fact it was by the scribe responsible for the bottom passage. In order to make syntactical sense of this reading, by the way, he added a punctuation mark after extenditor. Actually, in proper context, the logic of this passage dictates that the dot and dot be read as en, not enim, but it's easy to see how it could be misinterpreted by a reader or scribe scanning the text superficially. These examples should suffice to show that reading the Deus Spectibus in manuscript form demands considerable interpretive effort if it's to be done properly. The demand for that effort is compounded by the internal structure of the text itself. This isn't to deny that it's organized. It is, in an exquisitely systematic way. But, except for the division into books and chapters, that organization isn't reflected, or at least poorly reflected, in the physical layout of the text, most of which consists of dauntingly long, almost unrelieved swaths between chapter breaks. I say almost unrelieved because there is some internal punctuation to distinguish textual segments. Here, for instance, is a page from one of the manuscript versions of the Deus Spectibus. Embedded in it are six propositions, relatively lightly but clearly set off by paragraph marks, indicated here in shocking pink, with the inset providing a magnified view of two such marks. These propositions are unusually short, though. Many of Alhazen's proofs occupy two pages or more in this manuscript, the longest, in fact, extending for slightly over four pages. Following the logic of these proofs is rendered all the more difficult by Alhazen's almost complete failure to justify or explain complicated logical steps according to appropriate intra and extra-textual citations. The ones he does provide tend to be vague. At several reprises, for instance, he refers the reader to the, quote, chapter on images, end quote, in Book 5 of the Deus Spectibus, but that chapter consists of 54 propositions, so it's up to the reader to find the pertinent one. Likewise, Alhazen's extra-textual references to Euclid's Elements or Apollonius' Conics tend to be limited to book, as when he says, cum dicit Euclides in tertio, as Euclid says in the third, without pinpointing a relevant proposition among the 37 contained in that book. For the most part, then, the reader's expected to know Euclid and Apollonius so well that he can automatically call to mind a theorem in their works that justifies whatever propositional step Alhazen takes, no matter how complicated the logic underlying it. One final problematic feature of the text in manuscript form is the way the diagrams relate to the proofs they're meant to illustrate. Because they're placed in the margins rather than tied clearly to the appropriate loci in the text, the reader's forced to make those ties himself. In addition, there's every indication that the diagrams were drawn independent of the text. Consequently, they fall within a copying tradition separate from that of the text, which means that the scribe made no effort to tie or adjust the text to the appropriate diagram or vice versa. The long and short of it is that Alhazen intended the Deus Spectibus to be read and assimilated as an exceptionally long, extended essay whose complex internal organization would be revealed only through a close and intensive reading. Only through such a reading, moreover, is it possible to resolve the various orthographic problems inherent in manuscript production and thereby grasp the real intent of the analysis presented, and often mispresented, in the manuscripts themselves. With that in mind, let's briefly compare Risner's version of the text to the manuscript version currently on the screen. Here we have a portion of the same text in Risner's edition. Three things are immediately evident. First, the text itself is standardized according to an eminently readable Roman font, the M's, N's, U's, and I's being clearly distinguished and the abbreviations few and unequivocal. This text presents none of the interpretive ambiguities inherent in the manuscripts. Second, Risner's incorporated the diagrams into the text at the appropriate spot so as to tie the two as closely and clearly as possible. And third, he's broken the text into discrete propositional elements. More than that, as we see here in the passages highlighted in red, Risner added his own enunciations in italics, not only to emphasize a distinction among propositions, but also to provide a synopsis of the propositional element to follow. Even more than that, he supplied all the appropriate intra and extra textual citations highlighted in yellow to ease the reader's way through the proof, even explaining the train of logic leading to certain conclusions that aren't immediately obvious. But that's not all. Risner was at pains throughout the De Aspectibus to reconfigure the diagrams in order to make them correspond as closely as possible to the conditions specified in the proofs. Here's an example from the 22nd proposition of Book 6. This figure, which is mine, illustrates the following point made in that proposition. If straight line segment ON lies on the surface of an illuminated object that faces a convex conical mirror, and if its rectilinear extension OA passes through the mirror's vertex, the light radiating from that line segment will reflect to an opposing point such as C from some line of longitude AE on the mirror's surface. The proof depends on showing that a light ray from endpoint O on a line segment will reflect to C from some point Z on line of longitude AE, such that when perpendicular HT is dropped to the mirror's surface through point Z, angle of incidence OZT will equal angle of reflection TZC. The same will apply to point N, from which a light ray reflects to C from point E, such that angle of incidence NEQ equals angle of reflection CEQ. By extension, then, a light ray from any other point on line segment ON will reflect to C from some point on ZE, so all the light from ON will reflect to C from segment ZE on line of longitude AE. Here's the equivalent diagram traced directly from one of the manuscripts and relabeled in capital letters according to modern conventions. That this diagram is woefully inadequate as a representation of the construction just described needs no belaboring. All we need to do is compare it to the previous one. Not only is the perspective all wrong, but the mirror's axis AH doesn't even come close to passing through the center of the base circle as it should. But it's not merely inaccurate. It's inadequate. It's grossly inaccurate. Note, for instance, that lines HT and DQ in the right-hand figure are not only not perpendicular to line of longitude AE on the mirror's surface, as they must be by construction, HT doesn't even pass through the point of reflection for O, which lies outside of point Z. Note, too, that angle of incidence NEQ in that figure doesn't even look approximately equal to angle of reflection CEQ. Furthermore, it's key to the overall proof that triangles FZC and FEC be isosceles, which they appear to be in the left-hand figure and which they clearly don't appear to be in the right-hand one. So the diagram provided in the manuscript is not just a bad representation, it's a bad misrepresentation of the conditions specified for the construction. Here, finally, relabeled according to modern conventions, is Risner's version of the diagram. This represents a vast improvement over its counterpart in the manuscript because it actually looks like what it's meant to represent. Not only is the perspective reasonably accurate, but the angles of incidence OZT and NEQ look roughly equal to their respective angles of reflection CZT and CEQ. In addition, the two triangles FZC and FEC look roughly isosceles as they should. So whatever its shortcomings, this diagram certainly doesn't misrepresent the conditions specified in the proof. And the same holds for most, though not all, of Risner's diagrams. Unlike so many of their counterparts in the manuscripts, they actually represent the given construction and proof. This is crucial because one's ability to follow the logic of any geometrical proof, particularly a complex one, depends heavily on one's ability to see the steps and conclusions in that train of logic accurately reflected in the diagram that accompanies it. An inaccurate diagram not only fails to assist in that process, it actually obstructs it. It should be obvious by now that Risner transformed Alhazen's De Aspectibus from a complex extended essay requiring extremely close, continuous reading to a textbook designed for quicker, easier comprehension and reference. This he did by segmenting the text into distinct propositional elements, adding clear, concise enunciations to those elements, tying the resulting text more closely and accurately to the diagrams, punctuating the text syntactically, and providing copious annotation in the form of intra and extra textual citations, as well as explanatory commentary. In doing so, he made it possible for an intelligent reader with relatively little formal training or expertise in Euclidean or Apollonian geometry to follow Alhazen's analysis throughout the De Aspectibus without undue difficulty. He also made it possible to approach the De Aspectibus in piecemeal fashion according to specific topics or propositions. Such an approach is actually encouraged by the addition of enunciations at the head of each propositional element. If, for example, the reader wishes to restrict his study of optics to reflection from concave spherical mirrors, All he need do is select the relevant propositions in Book 5 and ignore the rest according to the synopses provided by the enunciations. It's even tempting to substitute the enunciations for the propositions themselves and avoid slogging through the actual proofs to reach conclusions that have already been given. Risner's text thus lends itself not only to an easier, but to a more sporadic and superficial reading than is possible in the manuscript versions or than was intended by Alhazen. How then did Risner's representation of Alhazen's text and the piecemeal approach to optics implicit in it conduce to the transformation of that science carried out by Kepler? The answer lies in a redirection of analytic focus. Alhazen's goal throughout the Deus Spectibus is to explain as cogently and coherently as possible the ways in which we perceive and misperceive things through sight. Every aspect of his optical account, from the radiation of light through the reception of that radiation by the eye to the technical analysis of reflection and refraction, is bent toward that goal of explaining sight, not light. Consequently, the Deus Spectibus is bound together from beginning to end in a complex web of logical interconnections and should be read accordingly. To mine that text for a specific topic or proposition is to misread it, because that process entails excising the topic or proposition from its appropriate context. The theorem just discussed earlier is a good example. That the light from every point on straight line segment ON will reflect to some point C from line of longitude AE on the surface of a convex conical mirror has nothing ostensible to do with vision and everything to do with physics. How the light from ON interacts physically with the given reflecting surface. But Alhazen establishes that fact only as a basis for demonstrating later that when any line like ON facing a convex conical mirror is seen from a given viewpoint, its image will appear to lie inside the mirror and will look smaller than the line itself. He then goes on to show that the more oblique the line is with respect to the mirror's surface, the more curved and smaller the resulting image will appear. So Alhazen's real intent in this series of propositions is to establish on mathematical grounds precisely how and why, under a particular set of circumstances, an object line will appear distorted when seen in a convex conical mirror by any onlooker regarding it from a given viewpoint. The same holds for his entire analysis of reflection and refraction. Its true focus is upon the formation and deformation of images, not the physics of light. Within the framework of Alhazen's optical analysis, then, the physical account of light can't be legitimately separated from the account of visual perception to which it's accommodated because the two are so thoroughly intertwined. Yet, this is precisely what Kepler did in shifting the analytic focus of optics from sight to light, and thus disentangling the one from the other as independent subjects of analysis. Henceforth, the study of optics would be pretty much limited to the physical manifestations of light and color, with little or no regard for their visual manifestations. This new, restrictive view of optics and its subject matter grew out of Kepler's realization that Alhazen's physical analysis of light didn't adequately explain image formation in the eye, or for that matter, in curved mirrors or refracting media. And that realization was prompted, at least in part, by a selective topical reading of Alhazen's Deus Spectibus in Risner's edition, a reading that brought into stark relief certain internal inconsistencies in Alhazen's account of light that were obscured by the overall account of vision into which that account was folded. It's more than a little ironic, then, that in an effort to place Alhazen's Deus Spectibus on a firm textual footing, Risner opened it to a new, critical kind of reading that proved to be its undoing. Let me conclude by briefly addressing the question implicit in the subtitle of this talk. What made the printing revolution revolutionary? To generalize from the case study I just provided is admittedly risky because it's based on a very, very specialized text, excuse me, and as such represents the tip of the 16th century publishing iceberg. Most of that iceberg is weighed down at the bottom by almanacs and how-to books, and small wonder because that's what sold. Printer publishers may have been intellectuals, but they were also entrepreneurs, and fortunes could be made from publishing almanacs. Rarely, if ever, was a fortune made from publishing technical treatises like Risner's Opticae Thesaurus. Still, there was a steady stream of such publications, technical publications, some of them based on old texts, many of them on new ones. Thus, by the later 16th century, Europe was experiencing an information revolution equivalent in kind to today's, though certainly not in degree. So here's my risky generalization. Like us today, readers of the later 16th century, Johann Kepler among them, were faced with the problem of how to handle that information, how to filter it, how to interpret it, how to absorb it, and how to apply it to new uses and understandings. Confronted with an information overload, they could no longer afford to devote the time necessary for the intense contemplative reading required by manuscripts, a kind of reading oriented toward both mastery and memorization. Having created this problem, 16th century publisher printers resolved it, perhaps unwittingly, by reconfiguring texts in a way that made them susceptible to easier, quicker, and more superficial reading and apprehension. In doing so, they created not only a new, but a more impatient, and I might add, silent readership, one that was less interested in the process of getting to the point than in just getting the point itself. Suffice it to say, we today have far more in common with these silent, impatient early modern readers than with their mumbling, contemplative medieval predecessors. I'd venture to say, in fact, that we have more in common with these early modern readers than they did with their medieval predecessors. Suffice it also to say that, as new media have gained sway over the past several decades, we've grown increasingly impatient with the printed page, preferring our text to be not only visual or digital, but also more concise and compact, and a lot simpler and more flexible. Those among us of a certain age may decry this tendency and the resulting loss of what E.D. Hirsch calls cultural literacy, but one might as well complain about the tides. On balance, in fact, it's probably a good thing because it's a product of cultural evolution and, as such, a sign of cultural vitality rather than degeneration. Or at least that's what I, as a teacher, keep reminding myself semester after semester. That said, I want to show you one last thing in order to bring this talk to what I think is a fitting close. Okay, this is called Medieval Help Desk. What? Oh.
Så langt kom jeg altså. Ok, men så stoppet du opp, og så var jeg redd for at noe av teksten skulle forsvinne. Så jeg putter opp videre.
Ja, ok. Men hvis du skriver her, så blir det kanskje flere enn 100 sider med lager tekst. Så for å komme videre, så tar du tak i et ark, og måtte her. Så blar du over på neste side og da fortsetter teksten der.
Du blar, altså.
Du blar. Men tilbake da. Ja, da bare blar du tilbake igjen på plass der. Tilbake til resten.
Ok, så slutter der. Og så... Så oppsikker den da.
Så du sammen fermene.
Ja.
På den måten der. Ja. Jeg lukker frem, ligger alt lager til det der.
Ok, hvis ikke den slå teksten her,
så
er det ikke lager til
det her. Ja, det er ikke det som betyr, men jeg har ikke det riktig sannsynlig.
Ja, men for det er noe med at hvis du har holdt på med skriftruller, så tar det litt tid på å konvertere som glad i en bøk. Ja, det er ikke det. Ja, men det er det vi prøver å gå inn en gang til. Ok, jeg åpner. Sånn, og så, hva er det kalt det?
Blar.
Det er blar. Blar frem og tilbake. Og
når
jeg er ferdig, så bare lukker jeg den. Flott, det er kjempefint. Ja, men du, ikke sant? Nå er det for det, nå får jeg ikke åpnet den.
Thank you.
like to thank Professor Smith for an intriguing lecture. I'm Jonathan Sperber, Chairman of the History Department. And you've seen here on campus, for the whole campus, what we in the History Department have known for many years, Professor Smith's enormous erudition, his ability to take the most abstruse of topics and show their enormous significance and importance, a true voyage of intellectual discovery, and the very wicked sense of humor he uses in doing so. On behalf of Chancellor Brady Deaton, who has heard from the provost is in Southeast Asia, and on behalf of the also absent Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, Michael O'Brien, who is on his own voyage of discovery to potential donors' bank accounts, I am honored to present Professor Smith with a special plaque commemorating this occasion.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And let me just read a few things from the plaque. The Office of the MU Chancellor presents this plaque to Professor Smith because he is an outstanding faculty member and discoverer, because he is an inspiration to the university community. We celebrate his excellence and service in delivering this year's 20th Century Core of Discovery Lecture. On behalf of Professor Smith, thank you all for coming, and please join us for a reception in the lobby.